How would you like to create generational wealth with property? Shannon Essek will tell us how. And what's so special about Shannon is she's a trusted advisor to first generation high earning professionals, helping them build and protect generational wealth using strategies typically reserved for the top 1%. And with a unique blend of legal, financial, and business expertise, she breaks down complex concepts into actionable steps, empowering clients to take ownership of their financial futures. So, Shannon, tell us about what are the three pillars of generational wealth, and where does property fit into that?
Property Wealth Strategies podcast with Lily Patrashko shares world's most influential property investors, sharing their strategies for making money with property.
Gladly. So just to give you a bit of background about the three pillars of wealth, there's I organize them into essentially the mindset mastery of ways that investors think and process information, and then strategies. So that breaks down into the cash flow strategies and tax strategies, and then what I call the vault or risk asset protection, risk management strategies. Property is one of the cash flowing techniques that typically also has a tax strategy benefit if done well.
Thank you. So tell us, how should someone create generational wealth with property? What's your blueprint for doing so?
Got it. So when it comes to creating generational wealth with property, part of it depends on where you start. And I always start people with the way of thinking. And the way of thinking about it is effectively, a lot of people, we have emotions, right? We're going to go into things. We're excited at first. And then we get the reality of it while we're in the middle of it and everything's hard and it all seems impossible. And then we have that moment where something clicks, or we have to know when to exit, right? We have to know exactly what our strengths are and actually appreciate the fact that our weaknesses are really just the inverse of our strengths. So everything's connected. So the things you don't appreciate about yourself impact the things that you would love about yourself if you found them. So I start there, because finding the right property, it becomes an emotional decision. And you have to actually have criteria to evaluate what makes a good property, what makes a bad one, because at the end of the day, it needs to cash flow. And then as one of the partners who I learned strategy and law from told me, he was like, first, you find the deal. And the deal has to be good on its own, even besides the tax benefits. And then you use the tax benefits as a sweetener. It just makes it a better deal. And so ultimately, we have to make sure that we qualify for whatever tax rule we're using. So if someone is full-time in property, they might be able to qualify for real estate professional status, which is a tax advantage status where they can take a lot of paper losses. And if they structure it right, it has many benefits across their entire portfolio. Somebody who's working full-time may not be able to use that rule. So they might use what's called the short-term rental rule. And effectively with that rule, they have to work on their property more than anyone else. This is the part that people forget, and do it at least 100 hours. But that's doable with most professional jobs. And you don't have to prove that you did that particular real estate activity more than you did anything else. So it's knowing what rule you're working with and choosing the way you want to go first, and then maybe using it strategically for a long-term gain. A lot of people think of, oh, the real estate, the cash flow, but they forget about the long-term gain. And true investors are always thinking about, how does this play out in my goals long-term?
Thank you. I worked as a property manager for 14 years. And what I've noticed is that I was managing 30 properties at some point, and they were great deals for like, I don't know, 10 years. And then, you know, the pandemic happened, and then they were not a loss, but they were not like making so much as to kind of make it sustainable to actually hold on to them. So I'm wondering about, what should someone put in place to make sure that their property deals remain sustainable and great over the long term, aside from what you mentioned?
Yes. Yeah, so some of the specific things that people can do, and part of it's strategy, right? So part there's going to be, are you buying property using debt and financing, which is going to be most people, or are you buying it in cash, or are you paying them off? You have to factor in that in a good time, yeah, you're probably not going to have as many, you know, tenants who don't pay, evictions, and all those complications. But in bad times, whatever the average percentage that you might expect normally, at least double it. Like, expect it to go wrong. If, you know, your maximum percentage is 5% of vacancies, plan for 10, plan for potentially 15% or 20 in bad times. So just keep that in mind. So if you're operating in good times, like you could have 20% vacancies, what happens is you build up a bigger set of reserves. And so in those bad times, you have more cushion than you otherwise would. And a lot of people, everyone plans for the good times. And the problem is, those are part of life and those are part of the times, but it's not all of them. And those rough patches, when they hit really hard. So if you've already built in that cushion there, you're not eating into your expected profit. So it has a different psychological effect on you when you're facing it. So that's one of the other ways to do it. Some parts of it are ultimately, like even on one of the nonprofits that I advise, I was saying we have a flush balance sheet now. If we're going to set up the, you know, credit line to borrow, we want to do it while we have it, not when we need it. So giving yourself other ways of accessing cash or capital when things are a little bit not going great, so then you can weather that time, is a strategy that people can use. I know somebody who was an investor who always said that, you know, he would keep a certain percentage of his portfolio financed, and then another percentage of his portfolio was not financed. So ultimately, by having the part of his portfolio that wasn't financed, he had extra cushion. Like, the biggest thing I think is building in cushion. So however people choose to do it, and the best investors over time will have all like 3-5 different methods of creating cushion. But when you start small. So find one way of having cushion. I think planning for a higher vacancy rate than you're used to, planning for a higher eviction rate than you're used to, and then have the pleasant surprise of not having it, as opposed to planning for, you know, no evictions, no tenant problems, any of that stuff, is one of the number one ways to make things go. Now, granted, economies change, but I think the tenants are the first to feel it. And then the landlord feels it as a result. So that's why I start with the tenant problem. The other issue is part of it is finding the property you want. You mentioned you found some great properties and they were great for 10 years. Part of it is understanding when you get a property, what is their maintenance cycle? The roofs have like a 20-year useful life. If you're getting a property and the roof was just changed, congratulations. It's 2-3 years old or less. You have it for a longer runway before you have to make improvements. If the roof hasn't been repaired in a certain amount of time, you're going to have less runway. Understanding where things are in their useful life cycle before acquiring the property will give you more to manage, as far as more information for management purposes. And then the utilities. This is particularly something that hits landlords hard when they have tenants who pay the rent, but not the utilities. And particularly if the landlord is the one on the utility bill. So shutting off utilities, you have to pay them to keep the property going if you can't separate and segment the utilities into the tenant's name. And that can cause a lot of frustration for a landlord that eats away at, if you have a lot of debt, thin margins. And a lot of people don't know those margins are thin.
Thank you. What about if, let's say, you're making a good income, but it's not enough to actually create any sort of cushion? Where would you start creating some cushion for bad times and tough times?
Fair enough. So if you're making a good income from the property and it's not enough to create a cushion, the first thing I have to ask is, how are you structured? And so the reason I have to ask that question is, this is where we get into the way you're managing the property. Are you qualifying as a short-term, you using the short-term rental rule for some of your properties and then transitioning them into long-term so you can get some bumps out in your initial years when you acquire the property or put it into service from the non-cash benefits that the tax code offers? So for people who are just passively managing a bunch of properties, they may have thinner margins because they're limited to the passive activity loss rule for active income, which means they can offset all the rental income itself, but you know, they have a job. They pay a lot of W-2 taxes too, and they can only use $3,000 of the depreciation against that. So it's not creating the boost that they might otherwise expect. So strategically saying, okay, for two of these properties, when I acquire you, like I used to know somebody who would acquire a property every year. In the year he acquired the property, he would always use it as a short-term rental, take that against his active income, get the tax loss on his active income. So then he would be able to boost his cash reserves and then convert it the next year to a long-term rental. So I have to ask about the tax strategy that's being deployed, and that planning has to come in advance. Like, you have to go in knowing how you're going to maneuver. It is much harder to do it back end. So if you're in that situation already where you're like, I've got 10 properties and I've got, you know, great tenants and they're long-term tenants, you're not going to switch to a short-term rental rule. And for good reason. But the best way to do it would be to create, it's like no one wants to borrow and have debt, but have the credit line available in a certain amount, in certain times, potentially that could be an option. Also, actively acquiring at least a property at, you know, while things are really good to start, like I said, getting that short-term rental rule boost, or qualifying if you can, like you were a property manager, you can that's real estate professional status pretty easily if structured correctly from a legal formation and tax structure, because you can choose a legal structure and a tax structure. And then if you match the activities correctly and essentially group your property management activities with your actual holdings of real estate, then your active activities will give you real estate professional status where you can take those losses from the real estate on the tax side without the cash, without interrupting your cash flow or having to get short-term tenants. You can keep your long-term tenants in place. So part of it is looking at what you have and making sure it's structured correctly.
Thank you. Tell us types of things that most entrepreneurs don't put in place when it comes to creating generational wealth with property.
Oh, sorry, say that again. It cut out.
Tell us the types of things that most entrepreneurs don't put in place when it comes to creating generational wealth with property.
Oh, there are a number of things they typically don't put in place. One, they want, and I understand it, they trust themselves, they don't trust many other people. But the thing is, from a generational standpoint, oftentimes I look at it like someone who works out. You can transfer the knowledge of how to do the workout, but if someone has never done it, they're going to know what it looks like to do a squat. They don't know what it feels like to do a squat. And if they've been a couch potato their whole life, and then all of a sudden they have no choice but to do squats. And I'm saying this after taking a 2-hour workout class that literally killed me despite the fact that I work out all the time. and they're in that predicament. There's going to be a lot of pain, right? Our muscles scream at us. well, the next generation, they're going to be in a situation where it's like they're taking a 2-hour dance class that's spent at least 3/4 of the time in a squat or a lunge position, and their muscles are screaming at them. Well, in that case, their property is screaming at them. So you want to essentially have an apprenticeship model with your family who's going to take over it, or you need to have an exit strategy. One of the biggest things that the generation cycle misses is having an exit strategy. And that includes estate planning, because many people own property. They own it in their name. Their business owns it, but they're the member of their business. It is not tied to their estate plan, including a living revocable trust, which means all that work, and if something happens, what the government will pay itself to sit on everything that you've built for 6 months to over 3 years. And there's no telling where you'll fall, but chances are the more you have, the longer the process is going to take. And just those, I like to call it living revocable trust shipping and handling instructions. Putting those shipping and handling instructions, like a bag tag at the airport, and making sure it at least can get checked to your final destination is the number one way, because the government can lose your bag, just like the airlines lose your bag. So ultimately, starting with that extra step goes a long way, because probate court can eat up easily 40% of the value of someone's estate. It can force the sale of properties. And at that point, it's like, great, your family might not know which properties are really the, you know, income machines versus the ones that are not, if they haven't been in the game. And then if they're forced to sell, they may choose the wrong ones, or they just, because certain properties aren't the money makers, they can't sell them. So they have to sell the ones that will sell easier. Well, the reason why the properties sell easier is because they are the money printing properties. And so that fire sale situation creates havoc. So planning for an exit and creating exits and putting in an estate plan is essential to passing things on. But nothing substitutes for that apprenticeship growth model on the generational wealth side.
Thank you. Tell us more about the three pillars of generational wealth that you mentioned in the beginning. Take us a little bit deeper in that model. And what would, let's say, a very successful family office or a very successful entrepreneur tend to put in place to make sure that their entire wealth is protected, including their property wealth, with the three pillars of generational wealth?
Yes. So the three pillars, once again, the mindset mastery, really thinking like an investor. So this is controlling your emotions. It's recognizing them. Don't discount them. I think actually one of the biggest things that will offset the, you figure 70% of wealth is lost actually from the first generation to the second. Of the 70% that is passed on, 70% of that is lost in the second generation. And then 90% is lost in the third. So really only 10% of people keep it across multiple generations. The thing that separates that 10% from everybody else is they give themselves space for how they feel. Like they're actually budgeting for the fact that they're going to have some good days, bad days on the feeling side, that there's going to be people who, you know, mistreat them and everything else, but they also budget for the fact that they're going to find good people. And as long as they know what to look for signs of good people, then they can always rebuild, because business is a reciprocity system. And ultimately, understanding those strengths and weaknesses, understanding, okay, it's not transactional, but it is a reciprocity system. You're going to give and give and give and give. And the returns that you get from giving are ultimately going to be more than enough for what you need. That mentality creates, you know, goodwill and equity. So then if you fall on hard times, you're more likely to meet goodwill. That's a way of thinking. The strategy side. This is the part where I tell people all the time, We're dealing with your skeleton and your muscles. The investments are the muscles. The skeleton is the legal structure. Putting that in place and leveraging the system, the legal system itself, so tax code, etc., they're putting these things in place. Real estate, when you're in property, that is your cash flow mode. Some will take it a step further and they will, you know, find other ways of growing investments for others. So they might do property for themselves. They might bring other investors in to grow the pool of cash, and then they get paid to manage not only the properties, but also to manage a fund that's investing. So people will sometimes expand, some people don't. They don't have to do that. They do not have to expand, they can. It just changes the cash flow dynamics in that they choose different things. They will, from a legal structure standpoint, they will separate their operations from their assets. And that's done for a number of reasons. One, if you have a tenant and they're only dealing with your management company and there's a problem there, then it's going to be harder for them to access the asset company. And the asset holding company will hold the property. I liken it to the traditional household model, where you have the traditional spouse who goes out, earns the income, and you have the stay-at-home spouse. Well, the stay-at-home spouse is not dealing with the riffraff. That is the traditional spouse who goes outside and earns the income's job. It's like, leave us alone. We're not here for this. And so you don't really get to the stay-at-home spouse. Well, the asset holding company is the stay-at-home spouse. Even though people came in the house, if they act up, that other spouse will kick them out. Ultimately, because of that structure, it means that you can always replace the management company pretty affordably because your costs are minimal, because you don't have to budget for, you know, the cost of the actual real estate. So if you have a limited amount of money in one area and someone sues you, they're really limited to whatever's in the bank account of that management company at that time. And it does have to be a reasonable level for what you're doing, but they're limited to that and the insurance. It forces people to settle as opposed to trying to drag you out and basically hijack everything that you built by going after all the assets when they really only had a problem with one, or the problem wasn't that big, but you just happen to be someone who has wealth. So because you have it, you're more of a target. So you limit what people can access. Also, by separating the management company or operating company from the assets, now you can choose a tax structure that works for the management company because you're providing services, and a tax structure, and keep a tax structure that works for the assets or the real estate itself. The two are not can conflict. So if you put them in the same company, you can shortchange the benefits that you can get for yourself. So by separating them and then essentially choosing a tax structure that can work for you from the management side, get income going that way, add benefits, now you can start playing with other tax rules and layering, which yet again, you're doing the same activities, but we just found a way to sweeten the deal without changing what you do. So that's the strategies portion. And then the risk mitigation, I got to some of that by separating the assets from the management, but I also, in having insurance, but going back to the estate plan. Those are under, like, making sure you have the estate plan and have an exit strategy, whether it's going to be 1031 exchanging for life and then maybe into DSTs, having, or Delaware statutory trusts, having flexible stability for the trustee to choose investments. And when, you know, that time comes, those things are really those three pillars: mindset, strategies, and risk mitigation that are essential.
Thank you. Tell us more about how protected is someone when, because I remember someone who came on my podcast and he was talking about how after that guest, so we were talking about how had a minor issue with a small company, and then he realized, oh, actually, this small company is owned by another, like, larger company, and now he was kind of, like, looking at, wow, now I have a really great opportunity because this larger company, I can make like a bigger claim against them. And I'm sure in the US, I mean, US is kind of famous for opportunists and people who are always like looking to do nothing and make money with the lawsuits. So I'm wondering whether does this kind of method of structuring that you mentioned, does it help at all in terms of like protecting someone from this kind of opportunist like I just mentioned, or would you say not so much? As long as the person actually knows that this smaller company is owned by a bigger one, then it's still a massive problem.
Well, if they can actually know, because you can obscure the structure. So if they can find out, then yes, they're going to have more ways to try and stay in the game. Some of it's going to depend on where you set things up, because there are different rules based on where things are set up. All of it could depend on the actual nature of the dispute. So, for example, in law, there's a concept we call piercing the veil and limited liability protection. So each entity has its own level of limited liability protection. So you have to be able to pierce through the first level to even get to the second one. A lot of people underestimate that. Now, the problem is, if people don't manage entities correctly, the odds are the more entities they have, the more risk that they don't have the practices in place that would protect against something like that. But the structure I recommend, the management company and the asset holding company, like the asset holding company doesn't own the management company. The management company doesn't own the asset protection company. So I like to tell people they're siblings. Just because you have a dispute with my brother doesn't mean you have a dispute with me. If you have a parent-child relationship and their child is causing havoc, well, sometimes you can sue the parents, right? Because they're responsible. By making it so the structure is either obscured, so you're like, we hope not for bad behavior. Please do not take this for bad behavior, but it's a very good example. You have those robber situations where everyone knows that somebody robbed a bank. And ultimately, they're wearing a mask. You can't identify them. They're wearing gloves. You know, you can't figure out what happened. No camera has found this person. It's not that the federal government can't figure out who you are. They certainly can. State governments can get information. But it makes it harder for a layperson to get information when you set things up in a way where, such as, for example, using a land trust and having your attorney be a nominee trustee. All people will see on the deed is the land trust. They don't even know the name of your holding company. You can set things up in a way where people can't identify you. That helps. And then, even if you do that, having some separation between the activity and the actual holding, the asset itself, is really key. Like I said, if my brother does something wrong, he's a good guy. He actually is. He's an amazing human being. But nobody can come after me because my brother did something wrong. So it works in the same way in the entity space. So sometimes it's how you structure, and other times you have the right structure, but you do need to obscure what everyday people can see, because it makes it harder for them to take the opportunistic route.
Thank you. What are some of the biggest fails, or some of the biggest, you can say, losses that you've seen, either for some of the clients that came to you with some huge problems they needed solving, or some case studies that you've heard in the press or that are related to losing generational wealth because of some stupid mistakes or some minor things that were not put in place that people just didn't think about putting in place?
Oh gosh, that list. Okay. Some clients have come to me and they have a bunch of property and they have it in all under the same entity, managed under their management entity. And they've converted it to an S corporation and those properties are financed. Oh my gosh, that is what tax attorneys call, we call it a nightmare. Because ultimately, if you try to move the property out of the structure, anytime you have property in a corporation structure, whether it's a what's called an S corporation or a small corporation or a C corporation, does not matter. Moving it out of that is painful. And there are all kinds of tax traps that have been laid out in code. Somebody had fun. Somebody was a sadist and said, oh, we're going to make it impossible for people to switch this up. The reason being, they have an incentive to do it now, but we don't want them to get the benefits of having a different structure later very easily. We want them to make a choice from the outset and live with it. And if it's to our benefit, yay. So that is one of the biggest mistakes I see, because what happens is if you try to move the real estate into another entity and you do not actually sell it to somebody else, you have an issue with what they call phantom tax. And effectively, you might have to recognize a gain where there is none. Most people buy real estate using financing. Well, imagine buying a $1 million property, putting only $250,000 down. The property ends up being worth maybe, we'll say it's not been that long, but it's worth $1.5 million. Your tax basis in the property is only that $250,000. It's not the full $1 million. So your gain, your capital gain on that property is bigger. And then if you try to take bonus depreciation, and essentially that is, you know, with the One Big Beautiful Bill, HR1, you can take 100% bonus depreciation on any asset in that structure and landscaping and things like that, that has a 20-year useful life or less. So you effectively accelerate it. Well, if 40% of the property has a 20% useful life or less, you actually can't even take the full value of that because it would exceed your basis in the property. And on top of that, if you move the structure to an LLC where you could have taken the full depreciation on that property, for example, then you're actually facing a potential gain, even though the property didn't change hands. So that is a nightmare to try and figure out, navigate, clean up. It's not an easy process at all. So that's one disaster that I know firsthand. And then there's the situation where people had property all in their name. It was all in their name. They had no estate plan. Something happens, whether they are alive, but just not available anymore. Like they need a conservatorship situation, or they do pass away. Like I said, a trustee gets put in place by the court. So you'll have a probate court situation where the government's going to pay itself off of your assets. And the way it pays itself often tiers up based off of the valuation of your assets. So, you know, I had a client who I had to tell him, because he was worth $30 million. Didn't have a single estate plan. I'm like, we need something in place. At this point, it could be anything as far as I'm concerned, and we can replace it with something better later. Like the sheer level of urgency. I'm like, I've seen families from just the estate tax, if they're over the lifetime limit, so there's a lifetime gift exemption. Once you're over that, the federal government takes 40%, but depending on what state you're in, there are different limits that you may be facing. So with no estate plan, like there are families who have ended up with having, just for inheriting property, $64 million tax bills. Like they actually don't have that in cash. All they have is property. So how do you pay that bill? And if you don't set up structures correctly and in advance, you built something for your family that they can't use. All they get is a bill for it. So all that effort was for naught if the goal was generational wealth. So the planning on the estate's tax side is where estate tax as well as estate planning side is where people often go wrong. I've seen people have estate planning, but not put either make sure the entity that holds their real estate or the real estate itself is deeded in a way that ties it to their estate plan. So then for that asset, for that piece of property, it's as if they died intestate. So that creates a huge legal bill. Lawyers who love to argue in court will be able to, their client is the dead person who cannot speed them along. And ultimately, they get to hang out in court and do what they love. And you get to pay them every hour for doing it. And there's some misaligned incentives that can be there. So the tax structure, not having entities in place, so no legal structure. The other thing is they will use, if they do have a legal structure, they will pay things that are personal out of the business account. They do not keep do books. They don't hire anybody to do books. They literally don't do the organizational aspects of the business. Then in the event of a lawsuit, they're at more risk because ultimately they can't show that they're keeping some separation between themselves and their business, in the sense a business is a puppet show and you're the puppet master or the ventriloquist. The goal is to focus the attention on the puppet, not you. But if the attention goes to you as the puppet master and the ventriloquist, like you're the best part of the show, that's never a good sign. The same thing happens in law. And so those are the common, very common mistakes that I see all the time, and they're preventable. If you're going to put real estate in a business, do not put it in anything that's an S corporation or a C corporation, unless you have professional advice and know exactly what you're doing. And I mean, a CPA attorney, and you need like three people to agree that this is the right structure, independently. And otherwise, it should only be in LLCs, and then what they call a partnership entity, like an LP or something along those lines. But typically, it's an LLC these days. Have your actual operations in another type of LLC, so then you can not have that issue. And then make sure your entities are technically owned. The member of those entities is effectively your living revocable trust. You can have anonymity structures in between them, but effectively, if someone looked through all of the, you know, the ruffles, the gloss, the makeup, it's your living revocable trust owns everything. You do that, you'll kill probably 60% of the ways you could go wrong. I mean, there's still, you know, a good chunk of ways to go wrong from there. But if you can kill a majority, it's a lot easier to navigate.
Thank you. Tell us where entrepreneurs can connect with you.
Yeah. So one of the clients I work with, Royal Legal Solutions. It is a fractional multifamily office where we actually help clients put these systems in place. So that's when they actually get to work with me to implement. You can also find me at shannonterrell.com. I literally will talk to people about strategy. I coach and teach the wealth system because honestly, the entrepreneurs who do the best are the ones who learn just enough to make sure that they're working with the right people. So they find, you know, that good CPA, that good attorney. Because everyone's like, I need a good attorney and I need a good CPA. But how do you know what one is? Well, I give people that information. I help them understand what's going on, why it's done. And if you know the why, you can always figure out the who and the what. And so I teach that. I coach on it. And you can connect with me at shannonterrell.com or you can catch me at Royal Legal Solutions, where I actually do help our clients get these things over the finish line. I have drafted and do draft like operating agreements. I actually look and evaluate tax structures, and I will have conversations with our CPA. And we have literally looked at client structures and hashed out what the strategy needs to be. One client was in a situation where they would have had, because of this type of setup, those issues that I named, a potential six-figure tax bill to restructure, and we figure out a way to legally bring it down to low five figures, like 10 or 15K, and then we could help them invest in ways that would offset that so they wouldn't have a tax bill. And they could actually get some tax benefits on a go-forward basis. So those are places to find me.
Follow me for more property wealth strategies.